1850-715-815.
Kate, hello, how are you?
Hi, hello.
Physician, heal thyself. You were a psychiatric nurse, Kate, and you ended up getting depression. Were you able to recognise the symptoms yourself because of your training, or did it take somebody else to standing outside and point out to you, you might not be that well?
Well, I suppose you recognise that there's a lot of difficulties going on, and but I, at one point I thought, well, being a psychiatric nurse and all that, and having all the experience personally, I suppose, with other patients through the years, I felt I could handle anything. I felt I could handle anything in life. Patted myself on the back when I thought I got through any difficulty, either my own or family or whatever. But I suppose things go downhill when you miss the light when it's flashing to tell you that there's something seriously going wrong. And I suppose you kind of go through the same thing that you think you're in control.
But you're not. You just can't handle this stuff.
You're slip sliding and you don't recognise it enough. So I suppose when a lot of difficulties happened, personal and family situations, and with my husband and business situations happened, that really was the start of the quick decline that kind of took me out of being in control, and where I was sliding and everything was sliding out of my hands. And I suppose it presented.
What do you mean sliding out of your hands, though, Kate? Why were you not able to deal with the same challenges that you had been just a few months earlier?
You see, you think you were handling them, but the fact is that, unknown to yourself, you're really slip sliding quietly, and you think you're still in control, but I think between the psychic and the whole lot, you don't recognise it or sometimes catch yourself in time. And it's like yesterday when John said he had suicidal thoughts, but I would never do it. But the thing is, and I just rang my ex-husband on it there, and he said, because we've both been in that position, and he said, once you have the thoughts, you never know when you're going to go there.
Mm.
Once you have the thoughts of that, it then, you know, you're not really in control.
Kate? Were you at that point? I mean, how close did you feel you were?
Oh, yeah. Both of us were at different times. Both of us were. And first of all, with my husband, when the depression hit, he went missing for 24 hours. And that was the first sign that things were seriously going wrong. And he said that only for the kids at the riverbank, there was nothing to hold him back. But that took then a lot of work and doctor's help and psychiatric help. And that works up to a point, and that's what I really wanted to, I suppose, express. That works up to a great point.
But there was nothing else. I'm just wondering, I mean, did you end up at the same place then as well?
I did.
But
yeah.
To what extent do you think that your depression and your husband's depression ended up kind of feeding off each other?
I was trying to manage the whole family situation and manage my husband's mental state. And because I was working in the psychiatric field and he was being admitted in another wing, I was trying to control it. And I suppose, I'd be quite honest, trying to keep it maybe personal and secretive and not letting other people outside know.
Mm.
You know, and it's amazing what you do yourself when you're put in that position. I thought I could still contain it and manage it, and that it was our privacy. But in fact,
the stress,
you know,
of dealing
we're all
with
human.
That.
We're all human. We're all human. And at the end of the day, until we let other people in to how we're feeling and what's going on, we can never truly allow people in to help us, and for them to give their hearts and openness. But I just wanted to say to, you know, in relation to John, I missed some of it yesterday, but my personal journey then at the end of that was going, I suppose, beyond the psychiatric role of you know, your GP and medication and all that, which I certainly didn't want to go down that road for myself. I suppose it's a bit of your own ego pride, and you think you're a bit above that, or you can do better than that. But I really would honestly like to say, and I felt compelled to express it, because I wouldn't be a public person to certainly put myself out, but I found the road for me was going down the psychotherapy road. And other things, I'll be quite honest, other areas. I tried everything. I tried all the holistic, all the other areas, and I went very off-the-rail kind of therapy stuff. But I tried to find something that would help me through this gutters of despair.
Why is that now, Kate? I mean, being a psychiatric nurse and presumably seeing the people that it has all worked for and for whom the pills were a help, why did you decide to go down alternative routes? Was that a pride thing again?
No. I could see where medication and inpatient help was there and everything, but there wasn't enough of it available, enough psychotherapy on a one-to-one available to the patients. Everybody is stretched in the whole medical and mental area, and I felt there really wasn't enough one-to-one. Mm-hmm. And we, as psychiatric nurses, were trying to be counsellors, where we were trying to be more than what we were really able to provide or qualified to provide. But that was a journey for me as well, to find it. But I was totally encouraged by John yesterday. He wants to get better.
He very much did. Can I bring in somebody else here, Kate? Just one second now. Pat, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, Philip. A little bit anxious, but I'm great.
Well, you've no reason to be anxious whatsoever, because what I think you're doing is great, because you are in part what John wanted to hear yesterday. You've proved to yourself that OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, is in your case treatable and containable.
Yes, absolutely. And I would have experienced it since I was in my late teens, and suffered with it, I could say, for 18 years before I discovered what was wrong with me. And that was a pretty difficult time, I can tell you. But I was fortunate enough to get a very good therapist around that time. And even though the cognitive behavioural therapy sessions only lasted maybe for about 3 months or that, the work was ongoing after that. And I would have had, of course, like any difficult journey you go on, you're going to have your setbacks. But thankfully, I can say that I'm 95% on a good day. I'd say I'm nearly 100% recovered.
Good.
A bad day, I'm maybe 80% recovered. And the danger is when you're at the 80% that you can dip below it. So you have to be kind of, I suppose, what's the word I'm looking for? Just, I wouldn't say on your guard all the time, but conscious of that fact, kind of. Uh-huh. And I'd agree there with what your previous speaker said.
Before we go on, just tell us, how bad was it when it was at its worst for you? What have you recovered from, in a sense?
I would have had probably most of the symptoms that are associated with OCD. The most common of those would be checking and hand washing. But probably the worst part of it, which I'm not going to go into here, I wouldn't feel comfortable talking on air about all the disturbing, unwanted thoughts that you might have. But I did identify with John yesterday.
Well, let's not talk about those. Yeah. I mean, talk about something like the checking, because this is the one that I have the most trouble wrapping my head around. Because while I might occasionally forget whether I've turned the immersion on or off or not, and what will cause me to check again is wondering, have I just had the thought recently that I must turn it off, or have I actually turned it off? What is it that sends you back again and again and again to check whether a door is locked or an oven is off or whatever?
I suppose it's important to remember that obsessive compulsive disorder is about one thing. It's about anxiety.
Right.
And what I learned in therapy this was an anxiety disorder, and this wasn't so much linked to whether the back door was closed or not. It was linked to Pat's anxiety. Even though deep down I might know or I'd be pretty mm-hmm. certain that I closed the back door and that nobody was going to get in and burgle the house. The fear of it actually happening remained with me. The anxiety okay. surrounding it, and I didn't feel right.
So you were in possession of rational facts that you might known that the back door was locked, but they were being challenged by an emotion which was saying, "Oh God, maybe it's not. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's not. Maybe it has to be checked again."
Yeah. What if? I do call this the what if disease. What if this happened? What if that? What if this? And the anxiety is so great, and you think, what harm can it do? Initially, when this started with me, I thought, what harm will it do to go back? And even if I am 5 minutes late for my appointment or whatever, I'll be okay. That's why they call it compulsive disorder, mm-hmm. because you're absolutely compelled to go back.
And is there a reward for going back? I mean, a sort of a hormonal or a chemical or
this
emotional
is where
reward?
I think the condition is so cruel, because there actually is a short-term reward. When you go back and check, you say, oh, thanks be to God, sure, I knew it, the back door was closed all the time, and I'm grand. But suddenly you're driving away down the road for your appointment, and then you think, I locked the back door, but I actually don't remember. Did I come out the front door or the back door? I don't remember closing the front door or the window upstairs mm-hmm. or the gas. There's always something else.
So does developing the routines then become a self-protection mechanism? You say, if I do all these things the same way every single day, well, then I know that I've performed my checklist.
Absolutely. And this is probably where the condition can become really disabling, is when you think this is harmless at the start and I'll do it once or twice. And a lot of people kind of do it maybe once or twice. But where it becomes really disabling is that the worse it gets, the worse it gets. And the more checking you do, the more you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And it actually can become a ritual. Things for me, checking and other things, kind of became became an hour-long ritual.
And what anxiety was it that motivates the hand-washing?
I don't know. I think it was a feeling of being right. I worked in a sales job, and it was meeting my clients was probably something that I absolutely loved doing, and it was something that I felt anxious about, and it was something that it was important to me to give up my best and feel right. So I think it was just a sense of feeling right. I honestly don't know. It was just a feeling of maybe I'll feel better if I do this, and what harm can it do? And suddenly it became a ritual, as I say. I suppose you could compare it to an addiction, and it's like an alcoholic. He takes his first drink, and sometimes he takes one more than that, he thinks, what harm will it do? And suddenly it grows on you. Mm-hmm. It grows on you.
There's an awful seesaw going on here then between the rational and the emotional, almost kind of, well, saying the head and the heart is a bit flippant, but you must have been at constant war with yourself.
Yeah, there was always a kind of a fear that something was going to go wrong. I often found that, like, just talking about work there, once I got started, I was great, but getting started was very, very difficult.
But did you start sort of the process of beating yourself up as well and saying, stop being so silly, get over this, and did it undermine your ability to have faith in yourself?
I'm involved with a group now, and one of the members said one night, he said, this is a very, very embarrassing condition. Or illness, I think he called it. I prefer to call it a condition now. And I prefer to say I experience rather than I suffer, because I think my suffering days with it maybe are over. But it's an absolute torment, because you feel, you know what you're doing is silly, but you cannot stop.
Yeah. Tell me then how it is that you recognise, I mean, 18 years before you actually realised there was something wrong or somebody diagnosed you. What was the catalyst? What sparked that bit of recognition?
I picked up the paper one day, and I'll never forget it. I was reading the film reviews, and they were reviewing the film Sleeping with the Enemy with Patrick Bergen and Julia Roberts, I think that was in it as well. Mm-hmm. And it said how this film was kind of, that it would have a meaning for people suffering with obsessive compulsive disorder. And anyone that's seen the film will remember the murderer, kind of.
The Patrick Bergen character.
Always insisted on the way they portrayed OCD in that film, I have to say.
He always insisted on towels being left a certain way on the handrail.
That would be part of it. With some people, the picture on the wall would have to be absolutely right. It's a kind of a form of perfectionism, I suppose.
Okay. But it was it was a mirror to you, was it?
It was an absolute mirror. I thought, my God, that could be what I have. Because even though I did, it didn't worry me which way the towels were. I kind of recognised it because I didn't have that symptom. But I certainly had other symptoms, like I've explained. And I just thought, that's what I have. And it was the most uplifting experience just to find the label. Because talking, you asked me about the battle with yourself, like the depression that I would have suffered as a result of the anxiety was very, very difficult.
What's the treatment?
The treatment for OCD, the recognised treatment for OCD is cognitive behavioural therapy.
Just teaching your brain to think another way.
Not actually, well, yes, teaching your brain to think another way, but the way you do that is through your behaviour. In other words, just staying with the anxiety. Because if I had, rather than turning to come back to see, had I checked the back door, if I had just stayed with that for another little while, it would have actually dissolved. But to stay with that, because you imagine what you're taught in therapy is to stay with the anxiety.
Yes.
And what therapists will do is they'll start at something kind of simple that you can manage, that you might have actually overcome
yes.
before. And just by learning to stay with that anxiety, initially it'll go through the roof. I remember what I said to my therapist when she suggested doing certain things. I thought, hold on a second here. You know, that's all right for you, but I have to go to work today after this session.
So
and I thought
I couldn't
do anything.
Don't fight the anxiety. Don't think that I have to be able to do something to dispel this, suppress it, make it go away. Just accept that the anxiety
Absolutely.
Is there and it will in its own time dissipate.
Absolutely. Feel the fear and do it anyway.
Okay.
And stay with the anxiety. And if you stay with the anxiety, even though sometimes it can take a while, but for a lot of people it doesn't take that long, the anxiety will level off and reality will click in.
Let me bring in another voice here, Pat. Excuse me just one second. Kira,
okay.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Hello, my name is Kira.
How are you, Kira?
Well, I'm very nervous. And
you've nothing to be nervous about here, because we've got our own great little self-help group going. I hope you were able to hear a little bit of Pat there. Do something for me, though. Break it down step by step for us what it was that you were going through. I mean, you were talking earlier on to one of my colleagues about what you do when you post a letter.
Oh, yes. Sorry, that phone is...
It's only somebody ringing to tell you that you're on the radio, probably.
No. I should close the door. If I went to post a letter, I'd post the letter and I'd have to hold my hand in the box and count to six. And even though I'd know I'd be doing that, I couldn't stop.
And you knew that there was no good reason for doing
it? I know the letter was gone down.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I didn't do it, I'd try to fight it and I'd walk over to the shop and then still have to go back even though I know the letter was gone.
And what was the anxiety, that the letter had somehow fallen out onto the pavement?
I don't understand. It's just that I'd walk around the box then and to make sure, even though I know the letter was gone in the box. I could totally relate to that man yesterday. I buy papers and I have a house full of clutter and I find it's a very lonely illness.
Uh-huh. And
I find I keep away from people because if I'm out in public, I have to check. And if people don't know me, I know I'm doing it, but I have to do it, so I isolate a lot.
Pat just said it as well. It's a very, very embarrassing condition to be living with. How involved is your routine for getting out of the house?
Well, for instance, this morning I had an appointment at 10 o'clock and it was actually therapy. And I had to get up at 6 just to get myself up and washed, and it took me hours to wash myself, and then I'd wash my teeth again and then I'd wash my teeth again. And then sometimes I'd get dressed and take off all my clothes and wash myself again. And then I'd be exhausted.
I'd say so. And is there for you, just as Pat was describing as well, is there a momentary bit of relief or reward from actually going through each of these things, brushing the teeth, taking the clothes off, putting them back on again?
Well, eventually I feel, yeah, I'm clean. Uh-huh. Eventually. But it is, I have been, my first session of therapy, I've been doing it since I was seven.
And if I was to come into the house and interrupt your routine and, you know, take you by the hand and say, come on, we're going now, I'm going to put you into the car and you were halfway through your routine, how much distress would that cause you?
I wouldn't be able to go. I said, I have been doing this since I was 7 years of age.
And what age are you now?
I'm in my 50s.
Oh, good Lord.
And at seven, like, just hold your hand out. I had to rub one arm six times, and then I'd have to go back and rub the other arm six times. It affected my schooling, and I didn't understand it, but if I didn't do it in say, turn off the switch with my hand, I'd talk myself. I'd say, yes, that switch is off. Yes, yes. I'll talk through it, you know. Obsessive compulsive. I've been with my doctor and he said anxiety caused it. And I went through a lot through it because I've reared two children and only I had very, very good neighbours to help me out. And I got through that successfully.
Yeah. Looking but after children can make you anxious at the best of times, but it can't have helped your condition, did it?
Well, I remember when my little baby was very small, there was times that I would stay with her. I would keep checking to see was she alive. Because I just would have this anxiety. And was I feeding her right? And I was down at the doctor every second day and the doctor copped. And then I eventually opened up to him and then he said I had OCD. And then they started giving me medication. And
So it increased the anxiety, but it actually made things better because you got a diagnosis.
I got a diagnosis of OCD, but then I was afraid to ask too much about it because I was afraid of the words. I didn't. And then he said I had neurotic neurosis as well. So they were big words to me when I was in my 20s, you know.
Kira, here you are, though, holding a conversation with me now for the last 6 or 7 minutes in which your thoughts are all very well ordered and you're able to describe what's been going on with you and you're obviously self-aware, completely self-aware. So obviously, if you haven't got out the other side of it, you've certainly started to manage the condition.
I feel sometimes like I can actually be crippled, like in the extent of, like, I recently went to the doctor. I saw on the paper where it said on the paper it's chemical in there's a Maudsley hospital in London, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about, God, I wonder could I get there. Maudsley, they call it. And then I said to the doctor, I saw something on the paper about you can have an operation on your brain. And he said, you're not having any operation on your brain. And I mean, it's so isolating and nobody understands it. And as I said, if I was at the bank machine now and I took out, say, 50 euros, I'd have to stand at that bank until I check around and around and just, I have the 50, yeah, definitely have it, yeah, I have it, and people behind me, and I'd know I was embarrassed, those people were in a hurry, but yes, I couldn't move.
And the cognitive behavioural therapy that worked for Pat, have you been down that road?
No, it was suggested to me, but I think I need to try my last. I kind of have felt a little bit suicidal over the years too, like, you know, and I feel I'll give that one more try. But I have paid out a lot of money now to try and get help, and I felt that it was more the money they wanted than help me.
Pat, what would you say to Kira listening to her story?
I would say to Kira to go to her GP, ask for a referral to a cognitive behavioural therapist, and it's actually part of the health service as well. That should come free, I think it's safe to say.
And how long would it take to get that referral?
Now, there can be waiting lists of up to 3 months, or maybe longer in some cases. Okay. I know in the Sligo area, I think it's three months.
For a woman who's been living with this since she was 7 years of age, another 3 months would be...
I'm in my 50s now, so...
Yeah, I would say to Ciara as well, it doesn't matter how long you've been. I found with the work we do in the group that sometimes the people that suffer the severest and have suffered the longest are the people who get better quicker.
Right.
And the reason for that is because they just have had enough, just like I sensed from John yesterday.
Mm.
And they sometimes take the two roads they can go. One is down the road of ending it all, which is obviously the worst possible scenario. Or they say, I'm actually going to do something about this. And I'm going to work at getting better. And I'd like to make the point as well, because there'll be a lot of people out there like John yesterday that will say, ah, look, I tried behavioural therapy and it didn't work for me. Sometimes it mightn't work for you because you're not in a place maybe where you're receptive to the treatment at that particular time. There could also be an issue maybe with the therapist. It's very important that you get a therapist that you can respect and that you can trust.
Right.
And I should say as well that there are massive advances. Going back, I suppose, to initially when myself and Ciara would have started suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder, there was very little talk or very little knowledge about it. But there's advances being made all the time. And I only discovered recently that in relation to the therapy, which one time took on a kind of what they called flooding, where you were kind of thrown in at the deep end. Now there's compassionate CBT, where, the approach is more compassionate, and they often start maybe at something that mightn't be that awful difficult for the person to deal with and get them to stay with the anxiety that's in relation to that. And by doing that, you learn that if I stay with this, I can beat it. And
it's a baby steps approach, and that you're not going
to be... Step-by-step approach is the key word, yeah.
And you're eased into it gently.
Eased into it, yeah. It's amazing the progress a person can make, we'll say, in a 3 to 5 month period. It's absolutely amazing.
Uh-huh.
The progress that one can make.
Ciara, John. Sorry, go on.
Could I add something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello. What's the man's name I'm speaking to there?
That's Pat. I can
Pat,
put the two of you in touch.
Yeah. Could I just say, I also have an eating disorder, and it's all linked up. And I also would be an alcoholic, and I gave up drink 3 years ago. And that has made a big difference to my OCD, because I'm not questioning where I was, what I was doing. You know, the OCD played worse for me.
Yeah.
And I also gave up smoking, no problem. Well, not no problem. Mm. I was smoking for 40 years.
Ciara, tell me, because just like John yesterday, it sounds to me like if you have taken the trouble of picking up the phone and dialing 1-850-715-815, that you're at a point where you don't want to despair any longer, that you want to take action and you want to do something about this.
I do, because I feel I'm a nuisance. I have lovely daughters and I feel I'm a nuisance to them. And, like, you know, to my lovely daughters, and I don't want them... my daughter worries about me 24/7. She's always saying, Mam, don't be staying in, Mam, don't be... You're a lovely person, and you know what I mean?
I know, but look, everybody has inconveniences and small irritations in their life. At the end of the day, you're a parent, you're a loved one, you're somebody who they are better off having in their lives than not having in their lives.
Yeah.
But I hope that's the way you see it anyway. Pat?
Oh, well, I'm at the stage now, as I said, I've had it since I was 7, and I'm in my 50s now, and I need one more chance to see, can I get to anything. I've went a lot of roads, so I need maybe another road to see.
Could I come in there?
Mm-hmm.
But by the sound of Ciara's accent, she's a long way from where I am in geographically, because I'm in County Sligo here, and the group that we run is in Sligo. But if Ciara, as you said there, Philip, maybe I can have an opportunity to talk to her later about our group. But
find a group somewhere nearer to her. Okay.
Unfortunately, the group that I run is the only one of its kind. There are support groups.
Okay.
But it's the only one in Ireland. We're affiliated to a group in England called TOP, which stands T-O-P, Triumph Over Phobia.
Well, maybe now is the time to start a franchise and see if you can't move it around the country, up,
that's
down, north, south.
I can assure you, Philip, that's the intention.
To be honest, I'd be willing to cycle to Sligo to do it, you know?
Okay. Well, we'll talk about it.
I've actually had it. I'd walk to Sligo to get rid of this,
good,
you know?
I've no doubt, Ciara.
And I can actually go to Sligo. I don't have... I don't honest. My family are reared. I'm on my own. I've nothing to do now. I look after myself, and I'll walk to Sligo every day. Because I've had it. I'm just fed up, and I'm an intelligent, smart person. And
You are. You know, and you've got a lot to offer.
But
and
maybe
it sounds
that
like
man,
you're taking
if you give that man my number, maybe we could talk.
We'll do that.
Know?
We'll do exactly that. Kate, I've ended up leaving you out of the conversation there a little bit. My apologies for that. Are you taking some heart from what you're hearing here?
Sorry?
Yeah. I'm listening to everything and, you know, sharing it and empathising with it. And if I could just say, you know, there's also emotional freedom techniques that we can all learn to help release all these pent-up emotions without having to fully understand what's going on. But there's so much out there that we can learn to help ourselves without relying on therapists all the time.
If you take that first step of actually deciding that you want to and you want to get out of this rut.
It's the huge thing. It's choice, having to make the choice whether we want to get better or not.
Good.
But, you know, I really appreciate what the others two there have said. And but I suppose what I'd also like to say is that for John yesterday, I felt, I suppose, a bit saddened that he couldn't live his life fully as a gay man as well.
It was very, very sad, wasn't it?
It was.
There were so many different things going against him.
But I said, you know, it's never too late even now. Even to reach out to the gay helplines and even to meet up with gay guys just for sharing and talking. But I feel it's just our old Irish mentality set that tells us we're wrong and we're faulty and that we have to change to fit in with what we should be.
And you're not, none of you, and thank you so much, all of you, for sharing so openly and so frankly and what I know is not an easy conversation to have over the national airways.
Could that man from Sligo get to me? Like, I want to do something about this, you know?
Kira, that's the very first thing that we're going to do now, straight after we take this ad break. We're going to connect you and Pat up, okay?
Okay.
Take care, both of you, or all three of you. Thank you very much for your calls. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Philip.
1850-715-815.
John, good afternoon. How are you?
How are you, Philip?
Why did you call to us now?
It's basically going back to the problem that there were people talking about CBT earlier on and different problems that they may have.
Cognitive behavioural therapy, yeah.
Yeah. Basically, my one is it's sort of a tremor. If I ever have to animate anything or like that, you know, say in front of people or that, my hand would tremor. And it's sort of there on and off, you know, even when I'm on my own, it's there a lot of the times, you know. Sometimes it's not so bad, but a lot of the times it's something I've never really heard discussed.
And is it an anxiety-related disorder or what is it?
Yeah, I think I'm not a nervous person, but it seems that it's just when, you know, I couldn't hold a cup and saucer in front of me. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It would fall. It's just gone back to one of the callers that earlier on. You know, like the guy was saying about having to check and double check. You know, he mentioned something sort of sat with me, like if you sort of get your way through it by just fighting it, well, sort of go with it. But I've tried just about everything. Like, I've tried doctors. Like, he has me on medication at the moment to rule out certain things. We know it's not Parkinson's anyway, you know.
Are there times, John, where the hand is rock steady and it shakes other times, or do you have a little tremor most of the time?
Most of the time it's there, but with alcohol, it sort of stops. But I'm not down that road, you know what I mean? I don't sort of just drink to make it stop.
Mm-hmm. And are there moments when you wake up in the morning, when you've been asleep, that it's not there?
Yeah. Funny enough, like when you wake up exactly in the morning, you know, for about, you know, 15, 20, there's nothing there. But then as the day starts, you know, it kicks in.
Or does it happen at the point at which you notice, oh, my hand's not shaking?
Yeah.
Being aware of it, introduce it and bring it on?
Yeah, being aware of it, yeah. Like, if I have to, again, I'll go back to what I said, if I ever have to animate or do something in front of people or even sometimes when I'm on my own, it happens. And I've looked into a few things, like a thing called essential tremor. And I'm thinking it could be that, but I'm no medic, you know.
How has it inhibited you from doing what you want to do?
Socially, it is very, very embarrassing. It stops me from going out. It stops me from mingling with people because you think it's going to happen, you know.
Mm.
And now this is sort of only happening of late, but it's always been there all my life, you know.
And you wouldn't like to find yourself in company with a pint in your hand for fear of drawing even more attention to it and making it worse.
Exactly, Philip. Yeah, like you've got people around you and you're talking away and, you know, see, you only have to get into the party and you're just so, you become so self-aware of yourself, you know. Do you follow what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
You're sort of very aware that it's going to happen.
And the more you're aware you become, does it make it more violent?
Exactly, yeah. And sometimes you have to turn away. Like, I've been clever over the years and covering it and, you know, people think it's funny when it happens. Okay, yeah, you laugh through it, but you don't think it's funny, you know. And people do. Some people think, what's wrong with you? And you're trying to tell them, I haven't got a nervous... I'm not a nervous person, it's just this, whatever it is. And I don't know whether it's...
Okay. Have you ever met anybody else with this condition?
No. Never heard, but I have research and it does exist. I can't be the only one in the world with this.
No, you can't. Well, look, again, let's put it out there to the 387,000 people who are hopefully listening today. Is there anybody else experiencing the same conditions as John?
I've never addressed it at all, you know. And maybe someday a miracle cure will come along. Like, as I said, I'm on various medications to try and calm it, but they ain't working, you know.
All right, John, thank you very much for your call and hopefully there is somebody out there who might be able to offer some kind of advice or point you in the right direction.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.